content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the December 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. On our previous program, we began an article titled The Costs of the Confederacy by Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler. And in this article, they've discussed in the last decade alone, American taxpayers have spent at least $40 million on Confederate monuments and groups that distort U.S. history and perpetuate racist ideology. We'll pick up where we left off. Very little has been done to address the legacy of slavery and its meaning in contemporary life. That scathing assessment of the nation's unwillingness to face the truth was issued recently by the Equal Justice Initiative, the Montgomery-based legal advocacy group that in April 2018 opened the first national memorial to victims of lynching. A few Confederate historical sites, though, are showing signs of change. In Richmond, the American Civil War Center and the Museum of the Confederacy have joined forces to become the American Civil War Museum, now led by an African-American CEO, Christy Coleman. The new entity, she said, seeks to tell the story of the Civil War with multiple perspectives. The Union and the Confederacy, free and enslaved African-Americans, and to take on the distortions and omissions of Confederate ideology. For a very, very, very long time, the Lost Cause has dominated public histories of the Civil War, Coleman told us in an interview. Once it was framed, it became the course for everything. It was the accepted narrative. In a stark comparison, she noted the statues of Hitler and Goebbels aren't scattered throughout Germany, and that while Nazi concentration camps have been made into museums, they don't pretend that they were less horrible than they actually were. And yet we do that to America's concentration camps. We call them plantations. We talk about how grand everything was. And we talk about the pretty dresses that women wore. We talk about the wealth, and we refer to the enslaved population as servants, as if this is some benign institution. Stratford Hall, the Virginia plantation where Robert E. Lee was born, also has new leadership. Kelly Dietz, a historian and archaeologist who co-edited a paper titled Historic Black Lives Matter, Archaeology as Activism in the 21st Century, was hired in June as the state's first director of programming. The site's first director of programming and education. Stratford Hall, where 31 people were enslaved as of 1860, is revising how it presents slavery. The recent shocking violence in Charlottesville, Dietz said, was speeding up the slow pace of dealing with these kinds of sensitive subjects, she said. I guarantee you that in a year or less, you go on a tour here and you're going to hear about enslavement. In 1999, Congress took the extraordinary step of advising the National Park Service to reevaluate its Civil War sites and to do a better job of explaining the unique role that slavery played in the cause of the conflict. But vestiges of the Lost Cause still haunt park property. In rural northern Virginia, in the middle of a vast lawn, stands a small white clapboard house with a long white chimney. The Stonewall Jackson Shrine, part of the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. The Confederate general died in the house in May 1863. The tendency for the park historically has been to invite people to mourn Jackson's death, John Hennessy, the park's chief historian, told us. He believes that the site should be more than a shrine, however. Visitors, Hennessy said, should learn that Jackson, quote, led an army in a rebellion in the service of a nation that intended to keep people in bondage forever, he went on. The greatest enemy to good public history is omission. We are experiencing a society now, the collateral damage that forgetting can inflict. A park ranger sitting in the gift shop rose to offer us a practice talk that focused reverently on Jackson's final days. The bed he slept on, the clock that keeps time, the ranger said a servant. Jim Lewis had stayed with Jackson in the small house as he lay dying. Black noted the room where Jackson's white staff slept, but there was no sign in the room across the hall where Lewis stayed. Hennessy had recently removed it because it failed to acknowledge that Lewis was enslaved. Hennessy is working on a replacement. Slavery, for the moment, was present only in the silences. During the fall muster at Beauvoir, the Jefferson Davis home, we met Stephanie Brazel, a 39-year-old African-American Mississippian who had accompanied her daughter, a fourth grader, on the field trip. It was Brazel's first visit. "I always thought that it was a place that wasn't for us," she said. Brazel had considered keeping her daughter home but decided against it. "I really do try to keep an open mind. I wanted to be able to talk to her about it." Brazel walked the Beauvoir grounds all morning. She stood behind her daughter's school group as they listened to reenactors describe life in the Confederacy. She waited for some mention of the enslaved or of African Americans after emancipation. "It was like we weren't even there," she said, "as if slavery never happened." "I was shocked at what they were saying and what wasn't there," she said. "It's not that Brazel, who teaches psychology, can't handle historic sites relating to slavery. She can, and she wants her daughter, now 10, to face that history, too. She has taken her daughter to former plantations where the experience of enslaved people is part of the interpretation." "She asked to know what these places are," Brazel said. "My grandmother, whose grandparents were slaves, she told stories. We black people acknowledge that this is our history. We acknowledge that this still affects us." The overarching question is whether American taxpayers should support lost cause mythology. For now, that invented history, told by Confederates and retold by sympathizers for generations, is etched in the experience at sites like Beauvoir. In the well-kept Confederate cemetery behind the library, beyond a winding brook beneath the flagpole, a large gray headstone faces the road. It is engraved with lines that the English poet Philip Stanhope Worsley dedicated to Robert E. Lee. "No nation rose so fair and white, none fell so pure of crime." Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section of this month's Smithsonian in the about technology, titled "Hitting the Panic Buttons" by Clive Thompson. Long before parents freaked over Fortnite, they flipped out over a newfangled game. This summer, a British firm that processes divorce filings discovered a startling fact. Of the 4,665 petitions for divorce they received in 2018, 200 of them claimed that the marriage had been destroyed because one of the partners had become addicted to video games like Fortnite. Or to put it another way, Fortnite and its ilk were responsible for fully 5% of all divorces the firm was seeing. Fortnite, for those who haven't heard the news, is the wildly popular game du jour. Launched in 2017, by this summer it had already amassed 125 million users, all of whom love its most popular mode. You play as one of 100 combatants dropped on a bucolic island, where you scavenge for weapons and try to kill the others before they kill you. The last one standing wins. It sounds grim, but the game's aesthetic is very cartoony. There's no blood or gore, so it's arguably closer to paintball than, say, The Hunger Games. Both fans and critics agree on one thing. It's remarkably compulsive. "I work with a lot of kids who sneak down at 3 in the morning to play," says Jennifer Powell Lunder, a clinical psychologist. "Twitter is afire with parents complaining about their glazed-eyed children. Addicted to it like a drug. Had to take the Xbox away for a few days," one mother posted. Schools have banned it after finding kids playing under their desks on their phones. The addictiveness of video games is now squarely in the public spotlight. For years, critics worried that games would breed a generation of hyper-violent kids, a fear that never panned out. But now the panic has shifted to how the games are designed to get kids hooked, particularly given the game-laden smartphones are with kids all day long. In mid-2018, the World Health Organization began officially recognizing gaming disorder, characterized by impaired control over gaming. As with violence, these fears are probably overblown, as psychologists like Powell Lunder note. "The great majority of kids learn to self-regulate and appreciate when parents help set limits," she says. "Plus, Fortnite has many benefits," she notes. "It's enormously social. It's really a good connector, attracting many girls and other kids who normally don't play games. So Fortnite won't turn kids into zombies, but it's interesting that so many fear it will. There's something about newfangled games, it seems, that deeply unsettles us, as we can spy by looking back 100 years when a new form of play rocked the nation, inspired inflamed headlines, and then was actually banned in many cities for decades. That dread game, pinball." Pinball originally emerged from Bagatelle, a 19th century pastime that was like billiards, except players propelled the ball through a series of pegs toward a target. The boozy, decadent courtesans of the French king loved it. They'd play these games and they'd go off and have sex, says Michael Scheiss, founder and creative director of the Pacific Pinball Museum, describes the general air of courtly excess. Then they'd drink more and they'd play this game. Not long after, the game arrived in American bars, and local inventors began tweaking it. In 1871, the British immigrant Montague Redgrave patented improvements in bagatelles. He increased the tilt of the board, and the player shot the ball upward with a plunger, trying to land it in scoring areas while bouncing through the thicket of pins, hence pinball. Redgrave turned the game into a tango of physics, combining gravity with muscular power to act as antagonistical forces, he boasted. Soon, coin-operated versions spread all over the country. But pinball wasn't a true phenomenon until the Great Depression. Legions of out-of-work Americans were looking for quick and cheap entertainment, so the manufacturing firm Gottlieb created Baffle Ball, the first pinball game to become a hit. The company began making 400 a day and eventually sold 50,000, making it one of the best-selling pinball cabinets ever. Pinball manufacturers quickly began to try to one-up each other by introducing new accoutrements that made the game more dynamic. They added round bumpers that would bounce the ball around chaotically, bells and lights and automated score counters. As pinball exploded in popularity, though, it began to develop a reputation for encouraging laziness and vice. Some of this was propelled by a Puritan disdain for unemployed Depression victims daring to spend a coin on some entertainment. There was the angst of, are these people ever going to be productive? This is Karen Sternheimer, professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and author of Pop Culture Panics. Playing pinball was a symptom of their boredom from lack of work, but was read as the cause of it. An adult spending their hard-earned money watching a ball bounce around instead of buying food for their family, notes Adam Rubin, author of Pinball Wizards. And many worried that kids were particularly at risk. The machines hold a special fascination for children, as Perry Githens, the publisher of Popular Science, wrote. New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia fulminated about pinball in countless interviews, blaming it for robbing the public and the pockets of school children in the form of nickels and dimes given to them as lunch money. The operators of the machines themselves, slimy crews of tinhorns, well-dressed and living in luxury on penny thievery. Plus, pinball back then was often regarded as a form of gambling. This wasn't entirely wrong. In those earlier, cruder games, all you did was pull back the plunger and see where the ball went, making it mostly a game of chance. Many pinball lounges egged on players by handing out prizes, like boxes of cigarettes or silk stockings, for lucky high scores, which made them seem like casinos. Worst of all, the mob liked pinball. It was a cash enterprise, good for laundering money, so gangsters financed pinball-making firms. It was the Depression, Scheiss notes, so if you want to open a factory and manufacture pinball, the only people who had the money who would lend you the money is the mob. By the late 1930s, LaGuardia had enough. He began commanding the police to seize pinball machines, smash them to pieces, and dump them in the Hudson River, eventually destroying fully 11,000. Though first the officers removed the wooden legs, 2,000 of them were refashioned as billy clubs. The mayor himself lustily swung a huge sledgehammer and, in press photos, wore a white suit while tipping a machine over to its destruction. Soon pinball existed in a curious state. Many towns and cities banned it outright. Los Angeles and Oakland, California followed New York's lead, while others permitted pinball parlors to exist or allowed bars and bowling alleys to have a few machines. In 1947, pinball changed dramatically when Gottlieb debuted Humpty Dumpty, a game with a delightful new feature, electromechanical flippers. Suddenly, pinball was no longer purely about luck. It was a fight against gravity, with the player balletically timing the flippers to keep the ball in play. Playing a single game for a long time became a mark of cool sophistication. Teenagers loved it. And in the post-war period of affluence, adolescence became a period of relative freedom and leisure for youth. Pinball was their meme culture. Designers would make games themed off hot trends, everything from surfing to blockbuster movies to major pop acts. One 1967 machine called Beat Time was themed off the Beatles, depicting four mop-top musicians named the Boodles. But pinball still hasn't lost its sketchy reputation. Indeed, the artists who decorated machines often leaned into it, creating cabinets filled with scantily clad women and sexual innuendo. The moral rot now wasn't about gambling. It was about teenage delinquency. Pinball was being played by rock and rollers. They were going to trash your house, jokes Weiss. Parents' fears ran wild. They're in public spaces meeting with other people, but it's not really social in a productive way because it's congregating around degenerate activity, says Daniel Reynolds, an assistant professor of film and media studies at Emory University. Better Homes and Gardens in 1957 warned parents to act now to keep your children from being victimized by the debased pastime. In sheer economic terms, pinball became a pillar of American entertainment. Between 1955 and 1970, it drew in more money than Hollywood, according to NPR. And over the years, the libel against the game began to erode. Part of what rehabilitated pinball's reputation? That 1947 improvement of flippers. Once pinball rewarded skill, even some grumpy politicians had to agree it wasn't a form of gambling. By 1976 in New York City, some council members were advocating to end their now decades-long ban. After all, licensing pinball machines and imposing fees would bring in dough for the cash-strapped city. So the pro-pinball polls decided to prove it was a game of skill. Enter Roger Sharp, a journalist who'd written about pinball for GQ and the New York Times. He discovered the game while a student at the University of Wisconsin, where forms of pinball were legal. The move to New York, where the only place he could play, illicitly, was an adult bookstore that contained a few of the banned Samsadat machines. On April 1, 1976, Sharp showed up in a courtroom in Lower Manhattan, where one counselor guided him to the Gottlieb machine Bankshot. TV cameras peered over his shoulder as he played, capturing the ball with a flipper cradling it before shooting it off precisely the location he described. "I cradled and called shots left and right," Sharp says. "I said, this target over here, I'm going to aim and hit it." Then he did one last audacious display of talent. He pointed out that he could even control the ball with the plunger. "If I pull this back the right way, it's going to down the middle lane," he told them. And it went in a beautiful arc and went right down the center lane, nothing but net. Even the council member who was the most hostile to pinball was convinced. The council voted unanimously to end the ban. It was a game of skill. He single-handedly saved pinball, Scheiss says. Pinball didn't turn anyone into a delinquent. Indeed, with the passage of time, the game now feels positively wholesome. Its sheer tactility seems like a bracing respite from kids staring at screens all day. There's a lot of nostalgia for pinball, because it does seem simpler, the sociologist Sternheimer tells me. You're not going to get so swept up the way you would with an online game. It's physically restricted, because the machines are so big. It's not something you carry with you all the time, like a phone. Many psychologists suspect the panic over Fortnite and the horrors of video game addiction will dissipate in a similar fashion. It's certainly true that some kids, and again adults, play in a compulsive way that interferes with their lives. But as Andrew Przybylski, director of research of the Oxford Internet Institute, has found, the circumstances that lead you to play a game in an obsessive way probably have more to do with your situation than with the game. There are indeed aspects of gaming culture that raise concerns, though, and ironically, they're similar to the ones that initially doomed pinball. The specter of gambling. Many video games in the last decade have evolved a free-to-play economics, where the game costs nothing up front, but it later encourages the player to buy loot boxes that have a random chance of containing a rare power-up or item. Players thus wind up maniacally buying loot boxes and blowing money in a fashion that's indistinguishable from spending wildly on lottery scratch tickets. Yet Fortnite, the game of the day, has comparatively few loot dynamics in its Battle Royale mode. It's very much a test of skill, as the psychologist Jennifer Powell Lunder notes. Perhaps video games like Fortnite will one day evolve in the cultural imagination the way pinball did. Maybe 30 years from now, today's kids will be looking at their own children, jacked into their neural implant and gazing blank-faced at a newfangled game blasted straight into their cerebral cortex. and wish nostalgically that everyone could go back to time to play something that teaches persistence and teamwork with the good old physical skills of using a real joystick. Fortnite, they'll sigh. Now we'll move on to an article titled Flake News, How the Holiday Letter Became the Snow Season Tradition We Love to Hate, by Anne Hodgman. Shed, Oregon, December 25th, 1948. Dear friends, wrote Mary Broussard, a homesick mother of three. Now that Christmas is here again, we find that there is too much news to fit into a note on each card. We have borrowed the idea of a Christmas newsletter from our friends at the Chambers and the Dans. So they're the ones to blame. Without realizing it, Broussard was among the pioneers of a new practice that spread across the post-war landscape in the 1950s and 60s, as more people moved away from their hometowns. A year-end ritual we have learned to love and hate simultaneously. The holiday newsletter has always been American-ish, efficient, egalitarian, and increasingly secular. Got a big boost in the 1960s when photocopiers made rapid reproduction widely available, as long as there was a solicitous secretary in the office to do the copying. And the U.S. Postal Service brought out the first-class Christmas stamp, encouraging more people to send holiday greetings. In the stamp's debut year, 1962, post offices sold 1 billion at 4 cents each. To most of us, dear friends' letters are highly disposable, but to a retired archivist named Susan B. Strange, they're keepers, a unique record of daily life. These letters are about family, she says, so often, at least until recently, that has not been captured by historians. Strange began collecting holiday letters in the late 1990s, and her personal trove of about 1,500 from 100 families, including more than six decades of news from the Broussard family, is now preserved at Harvard's Schlesinger Library, research devoted to the history of American women, where you will also find the National Organization for Women's Statement of Purpose, Miss Marvel comments, and the birth control brochure titled A Word to the Wives. It was women, after all, who wrote most of the family holiday circulars in the Schlesinger archive. Some were curiously specific. Has anyone noticed that the recipe for cookies on the Quaker box has changed? Some bragged about children. Others threw them to the wolves. Philippe, 13, is undeniably a teenager. He knows everything. His room is a mess. The most important thing in his life is his social life. Some rhymed. The snow has been flying. St. Nick's on his way. It's time for a Barbara communique. And a few veered into the dangerous territory of politics. One included a 1940s verse imagining Franklin D. Roosevelt telling the devil why he should be allowed into hell. I ruined their country, their lives, and then I placed the blame on my nine old men. Taken together, the emphasis, of course, is on the positive, and the great American talent for self-promotion is much in evidence. One study of holiday newsletters found that the leading topic was travel experiences, whether it was big. Also near the top, mom and dad's professional accomplishments, the kids' scholastic achievements, and the family's material possessions. At the bottom of the list were personal and work problems. Another published in 2007 documented a new fan-de-cycle syndrome, busyness. Analyzing about half a century of newsletters, Anne Burnett of North Dakota State University saw an increase in the use of words such as hectic, whirlwind, and crazy. Through their annual holiday letters, she says, people were competing about being busy. The traditional Christmas card was considered a vulgar time saver when it was first introduced in the 1840s. So perhaps it's no wonder that almost as soon as the newsletters appeared, they too became a punchline. In 1954, the Atlantic Monthly sneered that no Christmas letters averages fewer than 18 exclamation points, 2 exclamation points, or parentheses exclamation points per page. Ann Landers, in her syndicated advice column, published complaints about the so-called brag rags, such as one first printed in 1968 asking why normally intelligent people seem to take leaves of their senses at Christmas. Umbrage, of course, was taken. How can you, in good conscience, encourage people not to share their happy news in holiday letters? Chided Pam Johnson, the founder of the Secret Society of Happy People. We live in a popular culture that all too often makes people feel rotten for being happy and even worse for sharing it. Happy moments are good things that need to be shared more, not less. As culture wars go, this was pretty tame, but an Emily Post Institute survey showed that Americans were sharply divided, with 53% approving of the holiday letter and 47% hating it. The internet should have put an end to this oddly fascinating custom. Who needs a once-a-year family fun marketing report with Facebook and Instagram can update friends and strangers every minute. But compared with social media's beeping, hectoring fragments, a printed letter arriving in the mail, the stamp cost half a dollar, sent from an actual place, complete sentences, touched by an actual person, a real signature, now seems like a precious human document as valuable as ancient papyrus, if only people weren't too busy to read them. We'll finish today's program with an excerpt from Book Club. It's an interview by Anna Diamond, The Plot to Kill Washington. In the first conspiracy, thriller writer Brian Meltzer uncovers a real-life story too good to turn into fiction. Who was trying to kill George Washington? At the start of the Revolutionary War, the governor and the mayor of New York, both British loyalists, successfully turned some of Washington's personal guards against him. They were ready to strike, but Washington found out. The conspirators were arrested and interrogated in secret. And Washington gathered 20,000 troops and citizens in an open field and had one ringleader hanged for all to see. That sent a clear message to the loyalists without revealing the plot. How was the plot discovered? The New York Provincial Congress had established the Committee on Conspiracies, a top-secret team of civilians with a mission to gather information about the enemy and detect and thwart the enemy's intelligence operations. As the plot against Washington got bigger, people started to talk, and this little committee, led by John Jay, wound up bringing the whole thing down. It was the beginning of America's counterintelligence efforts. This isn't the revolution we get in high school. When we think about the revolution, we think about the colonists here who are fighting the British coming from over there. In reality, there are a lot of people in the colonies who took the side of the British, and lots of people from England who joined the colonial side. Some people changed allegiances back and forth. This created an environment of distrust and fear. It also led to lots of double-crossing and espionage. Why don't we know this story? The assassination plot is hidden history. When the British were coming, the last thing Washington wanted to say was, "Hey everyone, my own men just turned it on me." That is not the picture of leadership you want when you're in charge of the military. It's clear to me that he didn't want anyone to know this story. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.